This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Michael Ratner joins us from London. He just came back from Berlin, where he attended the 70th anniversary of the defeat of the Nazis.
The valor and the sacrifice of both the American people and the British people cannot be denied. It was the war the Nazis carried out on the Eastern Front against Russia and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics' opposition to the Nazis that eventually defeated fascism in Europe.
We'll speak with attorney Wolfgang Kolick from the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights.
We'll hear why it's not safe for members of the torture team to go to Europe. No visits to the Prado, no visits to the Eiffel Tower, and the House of Commons out of bounds.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Our own Michael Ratner has been in Europe, specifically in Berlin, in his capacity as the president of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. When he was there, May 8th is a important day in Europe because it's the day that the Nazis were defeated 70 years ago. And Michael was at a celebration of this historic event. He's now in London, and we got him on the phone, and we're going to ask him what it was like there. Before we do that, though, there's a famous poem titled September 1st, 1939. That, of course, is the day that the Nazis invaded Poland. It is the day that the Second World War started. The Nazis had vowed that they were going to destroy Poland and destroy Russia. And they threw everything they had into it, 150 divisions marching east towards Russia. And W.H. Auden, the great poet, was sitting in a bar on 52nd Street. And he reflected on that historic day. And Heidi's going to read us the first and the last stanza from his poem, September 1st, 1939.
I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame.
Michael, you were in Berlin on May 8th. That, of course, is the 70th anniversary of the Russians' defeat of Hitler's invasion into Russia. And there was a big celebration in Berlin that you were at. What was it like?
You know, I'm in Berlin almost every year on May 8th, at least the last two or three. But the last two, I've been there and attended various celebrations, or et cetera, around what is called VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, end of World War II, what the Russians call the Great Patriotic War. And I think people should understand the Russians lost 27 million dead in that war. It was by far the biggest loss of both civilians and soldiers of any of the parties to the war. And the Russians are looked at, if you really read the history, which I know you know, Michael, as the key player in that war and winning that war. You know, Hitler went against Russia in 1941. He got himself all the way to Moscow. The Russians then turned him back at Moscow and at Leningrad, and at the siege of Stalingrad in 1943, really forced a German retreat. Ultimately, the day that is celebrated, May 8th, is not just the day that the Germans surrendered, but really in honor of the victory of Berlin, where the Russians lost some 80,000 troops. I mean, we learn all our history in the United States as if this was Errol Flynn and the heroic American cowboys winning this war, but in fact it was the Russians, and you wouldn't know it was the Russians from history in America. And there was a huge celebration in Moscow we'll talk about in Berlin in a second, in which some 300,000 people who were the descendants of people in that war who were killed in that war marched, and many countries attended that celebration, China, India, but some countries snubbed the demonstration, and you can guess who those are: the United States, United Kingdom, France, and Germany. Germany came the next day to put a wreath on the grave of the unknown soldier in Moscow. But that snub is really outrageous, considering that without Russia, we might very well be ruled by the descendants of the Nazis from the 40s. Now, in Berlin, and then we'll talk about your thoughts about the war, Michael. In Berlin, there are three big monuments to the victory of the Soviets over Germany. And I've been to all of them. One of them is a giant one in Treptow Park, which has a 36-foot statue of a soldier rescuing a small German child, which is based on a true story. And this year, that happens on May 9th at the park, there were 10,000 people in that park, most of them, you know, who had either been, who were very old and in the war, or descendants of people in the war. There's also a Soviet tank outside of the Brandenburg Gate. And when the wall came down, there was an agreement with the USSR that Germany would continue to keep up these monuments, and any changes would have to be made with the consent of Russia. But in Germany, there's not much that's official. It's actually not as bad as the United States, but there's not much. The one event I went to, other than the May 9th event, I went on the May 8th event, which is the actual anniversary. And I went to a place called the House of Democracy and Human Rights. And that's a building in what was formerly East Berlin, which has a large inner courtyard and has offices for many progressive organizations. It was originally a building, actually, of what are called the oppositionals. Oppositionals were people in the GDR, East Germany, who were Marxists, but they didn't support Stalin and they didn't support the GDR. That's not saying they didn't support Stalin during the war, because during the war, Stalin played a very different role or a very important role. And I think you can talk about that, Michael. But the house has been taken over now by progressives. It's called the House of Democracy. And as I said, they're Marxist. And there was a celebration of a few hundred of us in that yard in honor of the Russian victory in the war for Berlin. And what happened when I got in there, there were songs of Brecht being sung by some guitarists and others, and there were projections on the wall of the victory and various photographs from the entrance into Berlin and the Brandenburg Gate, and there was a photo exhibit of a famous photographer from 1943 to 45 who followed the Soviet troops as they went from Moscow all the way into Germany. At midnight was the moving moment when they start playing, which people will hear on this show, the Russian national anthem, which is very stirring and moving, USSR national anthem, rather. And everybody gets a shot of vodka, a piece of dark bread, pickles, and a piece of what they call spät, I think, or ham, and you drink to the Soviet victory. And these people drink even if people didn't support the USSR in the sense of, you know, the internal politics as it went on, but understanding that what happened in that war and the victory was largely the result of the Soviet Union. And I know, Michael, you know some of this history, so why don't you tell us some of how that worked?
The aim of the fascist government in Germany was to destroy Russia. That's what they said explicitly. And they came close to doing it. At the end of the war, 60 million people died. They destroyed much of the USSR, 100 towns, 1,000 villages, many cities. And they killed, as you said, 27 million people. And if it wasn't for the USSR, fascism would have spread throughout Europe. So what the Soviet people did, they did for all of humanity. And what I wanted to ask you, Michael, is considering that Obama and the United States have snubbed Russia on this and haven't shown up at this celebration, and considering what's going on now in the Ukraine, where you have, for the first time since 1945, fascists in the government of the Ukraine, a government that was put in there, the United States brags that they spent $5 billion to do that. So how does this all fit in, do you think, with what's going on in the Ukraine, the attempt of the United States encircle Russia, and they're snubbing the celebration of the 70th anniversary.
Michael, you wrote me a note that was telling on this issue. You pointed out when the Russians went to war in 1941 against Hitler, that was only 25 years, or less than 25 years, after the West had again tried to destroy the Russian Revolution when they went in 1917. And Russia had been very weakened by that, and yet was able to rebuild its forces and its military to be able to win the Second World War. So encircling Russia, pushing Russia back, seems to be a age-old hope, wish of the West. So it happened in 1917. In the Second World War, of course, Russia at that point is feeling they've been invaded, they've lost 27 million people, and they're not about to give the West all the countries that they, quote, or that actually they really did liberate from the Germans, which are Poland and, you know, the whole set of what became Hungary, Czechoslovakia, the Eastern Bloc countries. And they felt, to a certain extent, that that was the buffer they needed against the West. And then you see what happens. The USSR collapses. The, quote, satellite states, or the now independent states, surround Russia, but many of them are still close to Russia, trading with Russia, etc. The West again begins its penetration to try and push Russia back in each of those states. And the latest manifestation is the one you've mentioned, which is the Ukraine, where the eastern Ukraine, which had a tremendous number of fascists in it, and had essentially a coup that the United States openly admitted to supporting, is another one of those efforts to try and push Russia back out of its traditional place, Crimea and the Ukraine. And we saw that other place. We saw that in Georgia. We've seen it otherwise. In particular, what's interesting to me about it is the West, the papers always point, this is Russian aggression. This is Putin going into the West. But in fact, if you look at the history since the end of the USSR, certainly even before, obviously, NATO in particular has been making a push into what are traditionally a realm of influence of Russia.
What lessons would you draw, Michael, from the American attempt to obscure and rewrite this history? What lessons would you draw for today?
You know, Michael, before we go there, there's one thing you mentioned that I think mentioned to me in a note, which I think is important. Both Russia and the United States entered the war in 1941, but there was the major fighting took place between Germany and Russia on what's called the Eastern Front. There was no fighting on the Western Front, really, which is continental Europe, until 1944 and the landing, both the landings both in Italy and in Normandy, which were, you know, important landings and difficult, and soldiers were lost. But one of the theories, which I think you put forward and I've heard before, is that the West didn't try and create a Western Front in Europe because they were happy to see Germany and the Soviets destroy themselves. And then they would come in after both sides were weakened because they wanted to get in into that. So one lesson you can draw is, you know, they were cynical in the very beginning, and millions of people may have died that didn't have to because of their cynicism. Another theory I saw put forward in an Oliver Stone film was then when Roosevelt and Stalin and Churchill met, that Churchill insisted on not going into Europe and creating a Western Front because he was much more interested in North Africa, going down through North Africa into the Middle East, oil obviously, and then over to make sure the Germans didn't grab what was then a British colony, India. So they essentially let Russia and Germany fight it out, lose millions of people while they sat there. Now the lesson is, of course, it's part of the same lesson we've had for a very long time, that Russia's the aggressor, Russia's the bad guy, we're trying to defend our freedoms against Russia, and that it was us, the United States, who, you know, with the Statue of Liberty in front of us, you know, freed Europe from fascism. Now, yes, the U.S. certainly played a role in that. You know, together the British and the U.S. lost some 900,000 people, which is a very large number, but it's not 27 million.
Yeah, exactly. The evil Goebbels, the propaganda minister for the Nazis, said towards the end of the war that they wanted to draw an iron curtain around Russia. What do you know? Winston Churchill in 1946, a year after the war ended, used the same words. Their intent was to roll back the Russian Revolution, or what was left of it. They tried in 1917, when there were troops from 21 different Western countries, including the United States, in the Soviet Union. They weakened it, but they were unable to do it then. And then they saw it bleed during World War II, and they finally were able to overturn nationalized property relations in the Soviet Union in 1991. So it really is the story of the entire 20th century.
Michael, you actually had a great quote that you put in the note to me when you talked about the invasion and that they were invaded in 1917 to destroy the revolution. And you have it quoted from Churchill, and I'll just read what you wrote me. Churchill said, quote, "We must strangle the Bolshevik baby in its crib." And as you said, they almost did. And then you pointed out that in the 24 years since they did that in 1917, the Russian economy was able to resuscitate itself and win the major responsible party for winning the Second World War.
Really extraordinary, because the Soviet Union, after the revolution in 1917, was nearly destroyed. Agriculture was destroyed. Animals were all killed. Industry was destroyed. Railroads were torn up. They had really left with nothing. And in 20 years, because they had a nationalized planned economy, they were able to build up that country to the extent to resist the Nazis. The Nazis invaded Russia, the largest invasion in history, 150 divisions from the top, from the Baltics down to the Black Sea, 150 divisions they threw up against the Russian people. And the Russian people were able to put them off and withstand that advance and finally turn them back. And for that, we owe a tremendous gratitude for all that sacrifice. And I'm sorry that the leaders of this country don't recognize it.
Right, and felt they could actually snub the celebration of the victory in Moscow. Quite remarkable.
United forever in friendship and labor, our mighty republics will ever endure. The great Soviet Union will live through the ages, the dream of a people, their fortress secure. Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand. Long live her people, united and free, strong in a friendship tried by fire. Long may our crimson flag inspire, shining in glory for all men to see. Through days dark and stormy, while great Lenin led us, our eyes saw the bright sun of freedom above, and Stalin our leader.
Michael, I understand there was a recent decision in the Swedish Supreme Court about Julian Assange's case.
I want to address that. It didn't go in our favor, although it was a split decision, and I'll talk about that. But the first thing I want to remind our listeners of is that Julian Assange remains in the Embassy of Ecuador in London, where I'm speaking from. And this year, June 3rd, will mark 3 years in the embassy. And he was before that a year and a half with a bracelet around his ankle under custody of some sort. And he's in the embassy now pending his extradition to Sweden, because the British court ordered him extradited to Sweden for questioning, not regarding charges, but regarding allegations of sexual misconduct. So it's now been 4.5 years since those allegations were made in Sweden and the issuance of a order detaining Julian Assange. It's at this point, because there's no charges, it's indefinite detention, essentially, without any charges. And if people recall, he went into the embassy not because he feared extradition to Sweden, but because he feared if he went to Sweden, it would be an easy onward extradition to the United States, where just recently the United States had said again that there's an ongoing criminal investigation of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. So in that context, there's two things I want to mention. One is, despite Julian's having been in that embassy now for almost 3 years, there's still a tremendous amount of WikiLeaks work going on. Just 2 days ago, WikiLeaks put up a searchable database of what are called the BND transcripts, which is the German parliament is holding an inquiry into NSA spying in Germany, and they were not available publicly. Well, now there's hundreds, maybe thousands of pages of them searchable with English summaries. So his work is continuing, which I think is the one thing he would want people to really emphasize. And a week before that, he put up a searchable database of the Sony hack emails, which, of course, have made incredibly fascinating and interesting reading. But to get to your question, Heidi, in the last year, he challenged, in the Swedish court, his continued detention under orders in Sweden that he be detained for questioning on these allegations. This is what, as I said, led to the UK extradition order for him to be questioned. The lawyers in his case in Sweden argued that he's been detained under a detention order from Sweden for now over 4 years, and there's been no progress in the case. The prosecutor had up until recently refused to come to London to question him or to come by Skype or anything. Only once we filed the case and got to the Supreme Court of Sweden did she say she would go to London. And of course, whether she's serious or not, we don't know. It hasn't happened yet. So the argument was that after 4 years, you can't keep a case pending on just allegations. And now to Americans, that may not sound, understand that, but they have a rule in Sweden and in Europe called proportionality. If the effect of a custody order or detention order is outweighed by the harm or the prejudice to the person who is in custody or being detained, then that detention order can be dismissed. It's called proportionality. So they eventually got, the lawyers eventually got to the Supreme Court of Sweden. The Swedish court didn't even wait for the reply papers from our lawyers, from Julian's lawyers, in something that rarely, in fact, never has happened in their experience, just decided the case without getting the papers. And it was a split, as I said. The majority of the judges said that they found that it was still proportional. The harm to Julian of a detention order was still outweighed by the public interest in having this case continue. A dissenting judge said otherwise. He basically said that it's just too long. You can't keep a person detained this long, not question them. The allegations should be dismissed. So we were disappointed in it, but the fact is that the dissenting judge did get it right. And we'll see what happens now, because it's pretty well at an end in Sweden. And now the question for Julian's lawyers will be, are they going to go to a European court of some sort, whether human rights or otherwise, where the guess is he has quite a good case. A fourth point I want to make on this whole situation is that even if the Swedish case goes away in some way, which I think is the most likely scenario because it's just the proportionality argument is just so strong, it's not the big issue for Assange. The big issue is the United States. And the problem is that even if Sweden is gone, the British have said if he leaves the embassy, they will arrest Julian. And once he's in British custody, then, of course, there may be, or there will be soon thereafter, a U.S. extradition warrant. So ultimately what has to happen is we have to get the British and the Swedish, particularly the British if we get rid of the Swedish case, to recognize the asylum that has been given to Julian by Ecuador. And under law, they have to recognize that. He was given that asylum in particular so that he would not have to go to the United States because the Ecuadorians decided that that was a persecution and not a legitimate prosecution. So there's still a long way to go, but at the same time, as I said, his work is continuing, and as I am in London now and have been visiting him fairly regularly, I would say he's in good spirits, and the work goes on.
Michael, we wanted to get your take on the recent sentencing of 40 months to former CIA operative Jeffrey Sterling.
Heidi, it was quite remarkable. I mean, he was convicted of espionage. He got a 3.5-year sentence. There's 2 points to make about it, or maybe 3. One is that he got 3.5, which is too long for a whistleblower. He's supposedly the source for James Risen in one of Risen's books, so he's a whistleblower. So any sentence is too long. But the fact is, the government, Obama administration, asked for 20 years for Jeffrey Sterling. So it's a completely outrageous ask. It's an excessive, a very excessive sentence in the sense that he's a whistleblower. The second point, which I think we always talk about, Heidi, is we always contrast him with Petraeus. General Petraeus, head of the CIA, discloses classified material to his paramour, and highly classified material. And what does he get? He gets to plead to a misdemeanor, no jail sentence, pays a fine. So if you want to talk about unequal justice, a real whistleblower versus a guy who's giving secrets to his paramour and who's head of the CIA. So you have to say that justice in any manner, every manner, has essentially fled America. And the third point is that Obama administration has the worst single record of any U.S. president. Obama has the worst single record of any U.S. president in prosecuting and persecuting whistleblowers. So we know we've had something like 8 different prosecutions. Everybody knows we have Ed Snowden sitting out in Moscow. Julian is in the London embassy. Chelsea Manning got 35 years, and on and on. So it's been a very terrible administration for whistleblowers, and it's been a real persecution and harassment and jailing under the Espionage Act.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me, and I'll see you soon when I get back to New York, Heidi and Michael.
Looking forward to it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Today, we can say with some surety that members of the torture team, from Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, the lawyers, and scores if not hundreds of CIA agents, are unwilling and afraid and fear going to the European Union and countries in Europe. Why? Because they're afraid they'll be subpoenaed, arrested, or otherwise forced to testify about what they did when they were part of the torture team. That result is in large part due to an organization in Europe called the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. It, along with the Center for Constitutional Rights and others, have brought numerous cases throughout Europe to make sure the torture team will be indicted, and certainly already at a minimum, some 12 years later, that they can't travel to Europe. The European Center for Constitutional Rights does other work as well. It litigates and brings cases against corporations involved in labor abuses throughout the world, particularly in Pakistan and Bangladesh, where sweatshops have killed hundreds of workers. We're happy to have with us the director of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, Wolfgang Kolick. He began the organization that emerged from a initial partnership with the Center for Constitutional Rights when we first brought the Rumsfeld case in 2004. It's a flourishing, progressive human rights organization. Wolfgang, as its director, also represents in Europe Edward Snowden, the whistleblower. Here to talk about the European Center, the torture cases, and Edward Snowden is Wolfgang Kolick. Wolfgang, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, we're here with Wolfgang Kolick, who's a close friend, as well as the founder of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. And we began, really, with the subject we're going to talk about today, among others, which is the torture cases. And Wolfgang and I in the center began those cases in 2004. And Wolfgang, why don't you give us a sense of not just the past, but of course that you're in a special place now going forward?
Actually, I came to the U.S. this time to talk about litigating U.S. accountability cases in European courts. And so we had a panel on this at the annual meeting of the American Society of International Law in Washington last week. And actually, the most important message is this thing is not off the table. This thing is not off the table. May it be off the table for even a majority of U.S. Americans, but for us Europeans, it's not off the table. And the interesting thing is, it's not only us, a small group of litigators, lawyers, and human rights organizations were trying to pursue cases on behalf of former Guantanamo detainees and torture survivors in Germany and so in Spain, in France and Belgium, in the UK. But after the torture report came out in December, it became very clear for us that even mainstream jurists within the judiciary system in Europe don't accept this. They won't accept it that the U.S. is torturing people and they go away without accountability.
Wolfgang, I recently gave a talk a bit about your cases and the center's cases on holding torturers accountable. And I said I thought almost as a surety that members of the torture team, which include Cheney, Rumsfeld, the lawyers perhaps, key CIA people, would be unlikely to travel to Europe right now. Do you think I was accurate in that statement? Do you think that's right? And that to me was a sign, perhaps, of your success.
Your success means the success of a whole network of people, and that's the interesting thing. When we started with this work in 2004 and 2006 with the so-called Rumsfeld cases in Germany, we always had been claiming that, okay, so this is our attempt now, 2004, 2006, CCR and others in Germany. But what we said, that this work might be continued by others in another place, in another jurisdiction in a couple of years. And this is what happened. What happens now? We learned our history lesson from Chile and from Argentina, where accountability took 25, 30 years. But now it's there. It's there. And that's the message we wanted to communicate from the very beginning. Don't think that this is a short-term attempt. No, we are pretty much aware that this might last longer than we want. Of course, we want accountability now. But still, we are prepared for long-term efforts. And one impact that was not foreseen by us when we started this work in 2004 and 2006 is that these people who were amongst the most powerful actors on this planet are affected by our lawsuits. And so this is something really remarkable. If you would have told people 10 years or 12 years ago that former President Bush, former Minister of Defense, vice presidents are not traveling to Europe anymore because they are in the danger to get arrested or to get subpoenaed or whatever, everybody would have said this is just a fantasy. No, it has become reality. It's not the ultimate goal we wanted to achieve, but it's an important step forward. And so this is politics. It's politics to think in steps and not to act in the category of victory or defeat.
We're speaking with attorney Wolfgang Kolick. We'll be right back after this break. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Wolfgang Kolick about his work at the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. Tell us how these lawsuits actually work. Where are they brought? How do you get standing, jurisdictional issues?
The most important thing is that the U.S. carried out a worldwide war on terror or on whatever, and that involved a lot of different territories, amongst them territories, European territories. So we have territorial jurisdiction. When a CIA rendition flight enters German territory, Spanish territory, Italian territory, when they abduct people in Italy or in Macedonia, it's an issue for European jurisdictions. When they maintain secret detention sites in Poland, in Lithuania, in Romania, we have Polish, Lithuanian, and Romanian prosecutors and judges judges who are investigating this. And we have a lot of European victims. Plus, we have universal jurisdiction. But for at this moment, our main cases, the Spanish case, the French case, and the Belgium case, they are on behalf of French, Belgium, and Spanish torture survivors. And even in Germany, where we're dealing with the case of Khaled El Masri, a German citizen. So maybe the U.S. should have been a little bit more reluctant and not kidnap and torture European citizens and not use European soil. But now that story is over. And so we of course, we're going for universal jurisdiction cases. But so far, mainly it's territorial jurisdiction and it's personal jurisdiction.
Why do you think the U.S. tortured people?
Ask them. I mean, it was in many, many regards, it was just stupid. It was the arrogance of power. It was a kind of, you know, it was there. It was maybe even a personal issue. You must be a certain character to think that this is an appropriate message to people, to whatever people, to the American people or to the Iraqi or Afghanistan people. You must have a certain mindset. And obviously these people have this certain mindset. But I think more important is it now for a broader audience to tell the people, you know, I don't like the argument at all, but torture didn't work. It's the reverse. The torturing so many people, Abu Ghraib costed U.S. It was a major damage for the U.S., not only, you know, in the so-called war on terror, not only in the margin of this counterterrorism measures, because it provoked more and more people to fight against the U.S., but it was also major damage for U.S. interests in the world. Because, I mean, the U.S. want to be an empire, and an empire shouldn't be only built upon military power. It's about the reputation. It's about ideologically. And they lost so much. They lost so much. They could regain a certain territory if they would be able to have something like accountability for the torture now. But they weren't able. And so they are still losing. And you, I don't know if you can imagine the level of anti-Americanism all over the world. I'm talking a lot to different audiences in Latin America and in Europe. And I'm litigating against U.S. torturers, and I'm also defending Edward Snowden. So you might think that I'm somehow anti-American or whatever. No, of course I am. I am not. I'm an anti-torture activist. I'm an anti-torture lawyer. And I'm defending whistleblowers, whatever nationalities they have and whatever the targets are. But I have to make this point. This is not about anti-Americanism in every single event, in every single panel discussion, because people are so fed up with the U.S. And so this is also a reason, I don't think in these categories, but some people here should wake up and see what the damage is ongoing.
But your cases aren't just against United States leaders. You have a case against the German government for their role in U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. And many other cases.
Yeah, thank you very much for making this point. That's the difference to the cases we filed in 2004 and 2006. In 2004, 2006, like 10 years ago, it was us litigating, representing U.S. organizations. Now we have a European agenda. It's a genuine European agenda. It's, as I said, it's European citizens that have been tortured, European territories that have been used. We have European complicity. I mean, some countries allowed the U.S. to torture on their soil. Some countries allowed their citizens to be kidnapped. And we have complicity in the drone strikes. That's a case we are currently filing in Germany.
That complicity is what? Because...
I mean... The Germany, for example, shouldn't allow the U.S. to use the airbase of Ramstein to carry out drone strikes. That's a clear thing. That's an international law obligation, and Germany is violating that. So we had to file a case against Germany and in German administrative court. It's also, when I talk about the European agenda, it's also a genuine European issue to maintain the absolute prohibition of torture. And I think the most exciting for me after the publication of the torture report in December was to see how many mainstream lawyers, how many mainstream jurists, how many people even within the judiciary system share this opinion with us. There is nearly nobody who's justifying torture. And it's only, the only question is European, are European countries strong enough to indict US actors? And they might not be strong enough at this moment, but who knows, in 1, 2, 3, 5 years, but they're definitely strong enough to arrest someone, to subpoena one. And when I say to arrest someone, to subpoena one, I'm talking not only about the CIA agents, the 13 looked after by the Munich court for the abduction of Khaled El-Masri. I'm also talking about the subpoena against Geoffrey Miller, the former Guantanamo commander, who got now subpoenaed in France. And there will be more cases like that. And the interesting thing is, nobody knows. Nobody knows. And if a random court in some European country thinks it's worth, they're, we have merits for an arrest warrant, they will file an arrest warrant. And this arrest warrant can then be converted into a European arrest warrant. So no matter, you know, which country of the European Union they enter, they're in the danger to get subpoenaed or arrested.
Wolfgang, we've been talking particularly about your torture cases and others, but I know the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, which you head, does a variety of cases. And one of the areas is corporate accountability. And while I don't know all the details, I know that there's a company with a great name called Kik or something like that, whatever it is. It's in Germany, and you've just done something about that. And to me, that's sort of emblematic of some of your corporate work. And the Nestle case is another one that I'm at least a bit familiar with. So can we talk about those two?
It's important to pursue cases like the torture cases. It's important to defend political and social rights. But more and more people are worldwide affected by violations of economic and social rights. And let's formulate it a little bit cautious. Mainstream Western human rights organization didn't pay enough attention to economic and social rights. And mainstream human rights organization are easier talk and litigate cases against Global South actors, African dictators, fallen Latin American dictators, than their own perpetrators. And I'm referring to companies who are carrying out their business all over the world and who are violating political and social rights, like, for example, assassinating trade unionists, repression against trade unionists in the Chilean or the Argentinian dictatorship, but also nowadays in Colombia. So that's one thing. The other thing is that we have inhumane working conditions in local factories who are owned by Western companies or are producing for Western companies all over the world. And that's one focus of our work, is the production of clothes in South Asia, especially in Bangladesh and in Pakistan, where workers' rights are constantly violated. And so we are looking for an angle to litigate those cases. And obviously, the two big factory crashes in Bangladesh and in Karachi, in Pakistan, recently. And so we recently filed a case against a German reparation complaint in a German court on behalf of victims of the Karachi fire 2 years ago, because we think there has to be established accountability of European companies for this kind of violations.
You also have an interesting case involving Gamma International that creates surveillance and spy technology.
Yeah, it's important to pursue also the export of dangerous, let's say, materials like arms, but also like surveillance technologies. Because the export of this surveillance technology, especially to regimes which are oppressing their own opposition, is in fact aiding and abetting torture and arbitrary detention. And that message have to be made. And this is a good example also. Sometimes we don't win in court, but the message is made. And in Germany, for example, we had recently a reform of the regulation. And so 2 years ago, when we started this kind of litigation, German companies were present at every single technology fair in the Middle East. And they were not regulated, their activities were not regulated. Whereas now the Minister of Economy, the Social Democratic Minister of Economy, has installed a certain regulation trying to regulate the export of these surveillance devices to repressive regimes. If it works or not, we will see, but still it's an important beginning.
Wolfgang, I want to go back briefly to the torture cases again, and you mentioned the Khalid al-Masri case and 13 people being indicted or something. I wasn't sure. But can you give us the bare facts of that again? Because that's one of course, your big hooks in Germany, is that one of your German citizens was abducted.
Yeah, Khalid al-Masri was abducted in Macedonia by CIA agents in the presence of Macedonian policemen and Secret Service agents. Then he was brought to Afghanistan. He was tortured. He was treated in an inhumane way. And after over half a year, he was released and brought back to Germany. And the interesting thing is, from the very beginning, the German prosecutors took his testimony serious, and they started to investigate. And every single fact Khalid al-Masri stated in the German court was later confirmed by different sources, most recently by the CIA torture report, when we learned not only that this torture had taken place, but we learned also that it was just a mistake. It was just a mistake that they had arrested and tortured Khalid al-Masri. Yeah, I mean, they destroyed a life because Khalid al-Masri cannot live like he lived before. He has a family, he has three children. The family left him. He's really traumatized. There was not even a single excuse. There was not sufficient reparation paid by the U.S. And, of course, not to talk of accountability. And, I mean, that's very poor. That's very poor. I mean, like, you claim to defend, you know, Western values, democracy and rule of law, and to enforce democracy and rule of law all over the world, and then this is a very, very, very poor behavior, not only of those who committed the crimes, but also of those who are in charge right now, the government who is in charge right now.
And there's 13 people who've been indicted, is that right, or charged?
The interesting thing is also that there are transnational investigations carried out right now. So it was a cooperation between Italian, Spanish, and German prosecutors that the CIA agent who allegedly participated in Khalid al-Masri's kidnapping were identified with the help of Spanish and Italian prosecutors. So they are looked after by arrest warrants. And as I said before, this is not a German arrest warrant only, it's a European arrest warrant. So one person listed in this arrest warrant wanted to enter the UK. Not to enter, wanted to work there as a CIA agent, and she was told, you better not come, because if you come and leave the aeroplane, we will have to arrest you.
And I think recently, after the torture report, I think ECCHR wrote a letter to the German government about what should happen to these 13 or something like that.
Yeah, it was a political decision of the German government not to pursue the extradition of these CIA agents. One might think that, you know, amongst close friends and allies like Germany and the United States, there is a lot of cooperation. There is also cooperation on legal matters. So one might think if, mistaken or not, a German citizen or a U.S. citizen is tortured, that the countries find a solution to establish some kind of accountability, which was not the case with Khalid al-Masri. Germany was too frightened to pursue the extradition warrants. We challenged that in court. But as clear as this case is described in the torture report, we think now there is a moral and legal obligation for the German governments to ask for the extradition of this 13 CIA agents. And again, it might be that the U.S. won't grant the extradition. Most probably they won't grant it. But this is, again, a message. We're talking about several hundred CIA agents who are involved in the extraordinary rendition program, and all of them are now in the danger to travel to Europe, because once they travel there, they might be arrested or subpoenaed. And this is not a small number of people.
At the outset of this interview, you mentioned working in coalition with other legal organizations, but aren't you also involving other transnational entities, labor unions, groups that are directly involved?
Yes. The kind of litigation we are carrying out, especially the litigation in the field of transnational corporations and human rights, we know that we are litigating against very powerful actors, and we know about the restrictions of lawsuits and law and court proceedings. I mean, you won't improve the labor conditions in South Asia by suing one supermarket chain in Germany or by suing corrupt and criminal factory owners in Bangladesh or in Pakistan. It's only in beginning. So the kind of litigation we are carrying out has to be contextualized. Therefore, we are in a number of coalitions with social movements in the Global South who have a very clear vision of how far you can come with legal work and when, you know, social and political activities have to be carried out. But they know pretty much that there is no reason not to litigate. There is no reason not to work on the legal level. But on the other hand, it's also not enough. And we don't have to wait for the results. We don't have to rely on the judiciary system. But it's important to carry out their own struggle with social and political means.
Wolfgang, one other area that I know, of course, we in the U.S. look at, you know, in an appalling way is when we see these, you know, boats of migrants across the Mediterranean. And this issue of migration to Europe, particularly from Africa, is a big issue. And I know you started to get involved in that. Can you talk about that for a moment?
This is probably the most outraging human rights violation in Europe. We have not even an accurate number of the people who died in the last 10 years in Europe attempting to reach European territory. We're talking of thousands and thousands of people, yeah, who lost their life in the Mediterranean or somewhere else. And although many people are talking about it, there's not really a change inside, because obviously, populist and righteous movement all over Europe are winning elections with xenophobic arguments. So in this moment, in this very sad moment for Europe, we think it's important to put this on the agenda. And when I say we, it's refugee groups and migrant groups all over the continent, especially in Spain and in Italy and in Greece, where most of the people had been dying. And so we're trying to sue cases, or to litigate cases against border officials who were directly involved in killings of people, like, for example, 6th of February in 2014, when Spanish Coast Guards shot rubber bullets against African migrants and more than a dozen died in Ceuta, the Spanish enclave on Moroccan soil. But we are also trying to build up cases against higher officials who let the migrant boat sink.
Wolfgang, we also introduced you as one of the lawyers for Edward Snowden. I'm interested first in the reaction in Germany to Edward Snowden. And, you know, we read these things that, oh, people like him. They're very upset about the surveillance and all this. But some of that as a first way to look at your work.
I mean, it's very interesting that Edward Snowden is not a hero for some outsiders in Europe, but he's a hero all over Europe. I mean, I don't like the word hero particularly, but he's acknowledged in a way that's really astonishing, especially amongst the young generation in Europe. I mean, this is the future. There are politicians who complain about the young generation not being interested in politics, you know, not taking a stand in politics, you know, not participating in elections, whatever. And they mean party politics. They mean party politics, but politics in the best sense of the world means the common goods, the common interests of a society. They are interested. And that's the wonderful example for many young people in Germany, but also in continental Europe. Take him as an example. And so he's I don't know the number of awards he got by many, many different groups. And you know about, because you participated as well in the ceremony, you know about the December Award at in Stockholm, the Right Livelihood Award, the Alternative Nobel Prize. I mean, that took place in the Swedish Parliament. And parliamentarians from all factions were applauding him when he appeared on the video screen, and that shows me that there is some hope, there is some reason to hope that things are going to change, because if you find the right angle to attract young people, and this is the right angle, people are frightened about surveillance, they didn't know what to do, and he gave them an example. On one hand, for us as his legal team, we try to defend him. We try to, you know, to save his liberty, wherever that will be. But he should have a safe stay. He shouldn't go to prison. That's very important, as you know, the goal of us, the lawyers. But as he says, and he always points out, this story is not about him as a person. This story is about surveillance. And this story is not, and this is also a mistake made by several actors, this is not only about surveillance carried out by the NSA. Okay, the NSA and other agencies in the US are technology. Their technology is better developed than the technology of most European, except the UK, agencies. But if they could, they would. And so we have the Snowden revelations are very important for our own countries. It's important that we have to find a regulation for this kind of surveillance. But this is also not only about surveillance by state actors. This is also a case against the global data enterprises, the Googles, the Yahoos, and all the others, because they are collecting the data later used by state agencies. So if we want to live in the 1984 Orwell described this world, if we want to live in that world, we can continue this way. But if we want to live in another world, we have to do something.
On that for a second, as you mentioned Google, as we're recording the show, I read today that the European Antitrust Unit is taking on Google in Europe. Again, an indication, I guess, of what you're saying, that they're a little more courageous there than they are here or what. But
they're under pressure. They're under pressure because there is a turmoil. And partly it's, I don't like it because it has a nationalist flavor. It's us, the Europeans, against the USA. Which is not the right take. I don't care where these companies are based, if they are based in the US or if they're based in France or in Germany. It's about a structural problem. But more and more people get it. And again, for me, the most interesting thing was the young people. I get many requests from schools who are studying, you know, what Edward Snowden writes and what he talks. And what's also very interesting, conservative jurists take a stand. Very conservative, you know, people whom I didn't agree with so far, but they are criticizing this, you know, this level of surveillance. So I'm really hoping that for the future something will change, because we have many people who are working for that.
Wolfgang Kolick, Director of European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, thank you for being with us on Law and Disorder, and thanks for the great work.
Thank you, Wolfgang.
Thank you so much.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.